Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy, with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everyone. My thanks to last week's guest, Cal Ripken Jr. If you missed it, please go back and check it out. All of our episodes, including last season's, are available for you on iTunes and Play.it. And, of course, there is an archive on WFAN.com as well. This week, my guest is Rich Eisen, the lead host, the face, if you will, of the NFL Network. Since its inception over a decade ago. Rich is a New Yorker, originally from Staten Island. He grew up a Yankees fan before gaining fame first as an ESPN anchor and now with NFL Network. Rich and I discuss some of his favorite memories growing up as a Yankees fan in the late 70s and 80s and his experience watching the late 90s dynasty from a different seat in the press box, or in some cases, the TV studio. Listen closely to his account of watching his Yankees win the 1996 World Series and includes some killer facts of life references. Rich's memories of the 2001 World Series, which we both covered, are also interesting to hear. For me, too, this was a fun conversation for me to have because I got to hear someone's perspective on events I was around to watch and cover very closely. So I heard a little different take on things. A lot of times I'm asking my guests about things I remember or that I read or watched on TV, but that I didn't necessarily experience myself. So this was fun in that regard. The NFL draft takes place later this month in Philadelphia, and I spoke to Rich about the spectacle and the show that it has become. He will, of course, be hosting for NFL Network. It's a big night for the NFL, maybe the biggest night any sport can have that doesn't feature an actual game being played. The interest and the TV ratings for this event are pretty spectacular when you consider the action involved is reading names into a microphone. But it's a show nonetheless, and the NFL Network does a fabulous job covering it top to bottom, as you would expect. Rich gives us a little insight into the production and the spectacle of it all. Rich Eisen also hosts a three-hour show, The Rich Eisen Show, 5 days a week on DirecTV, Fox Sports Radio, and is archived as a podcast on iTunes as well. Last week, as he drove to work in L.A., Rich Eisen was kind enough to spend 30 with Murdy. Rich, the first question I'd like to ask everybody: what can you tell me about the first baseball game you ever went to?
Oh, gosh, it was Shea Stadium. My uncle took my brother and I to Shea Stadium. Mickey Lolich was pitching for the Mets, and I was just thrilled to be in the outfield, in a box down the outfield, and meeting John Milner before the game. That's the first baseball game I ever went to, at least I could remember. And then I remember in like 1976, my public school PS54 in Staten Island had a field trip to Yankee Stadium, and it was right around then where I, you know, my older brother, you know, I realized he loved the Mets and the Jets and the Knicks and the Rangers. And I decided if I'm going to love the Jets and the Knicks and the Rangers, I needed to get my wins from somewhere. And Thurman Munson and Catfish Hunter and Reggie Jackson started winning baseball games in the Bronx. And, you know, I remember Chris Chambliss' home run to beat the Royals like it was yesterday. Wow. And the 76 World Series where the Yanks got swept by the Big Red Machine just crushed me. Crushed me, but I was a Yankee fan for life, hooked, line and sinker, then and there.
Were you at any of those 77 or 78? I mean, we're about the same age, so you would have been about 8 or 9 years old?
Yeah, I was not at those games, no. I think the first playoff baseball game I ever attended, I mean, make sure I get this right, but I'm just going in my head because, you know, the one year that Mattingly made the playoffs in his last year when I was a sportscaster in Redding, California, trying to start my career, or starting my career. And I remember watching Buck Showalter, for some reason, bring in Black Jack McDowell and Leaf and Edgar Martinez doing his usual thing against the Yankees, and Ken Griffey Jr. coming around and from first, and Brent Musburger with the call on the Baseball Network, and Jr. sliding across home plate safe in the Kingdom, and the celebration broke out, and I turned the television off, and I sat in the dark for like 10 minutes. So, but Mattingly homered in that series before retiring, at least. So at least I got a chance to see that with my own two eyes, but on television. Mm-hmm. So I think the first playoff game I ever attended, I think this has got to be the case, because I never got tickets when I was a kid in Staten Island growing up in New York, had to be the 98 World Series I covered for ESPN.
Wow.
That was it. And I covered games 3, 4, and 5 in San Diego. I didn't even go to the games at the Yankee Stadium. The one where I forget who the home plate umpire was. For some reason, he did not call Tino out on strikes.
Yeah.
Mark Langston on the mound, and everything turned around from there. But I covered games 3, 4, and 5 for ESPN Radio out in, well, it wasn't even game 5. Game 3 and 4,
yep,
out in San Diego. Those were the first playoff games I ever attended. Or I was at game 2. I was at game 2. For some reason, I wasn't at game 1. I remember watching that, you know, Tony Gwynn homering and getting nervous.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first playoff game I ever personally attended.
Did you have a problem at that point? You know, you'd been in the business for a while. You know, you obviously were at a major outlet. Did you have any problems separating your fandom from your reporting?
I never was a cheer in the press box guy. You know, I was always able to keep that in me. You know, from the first minute, I covered the 1990 Rose Bowl, Bo Schembechler's last game for the Michigan Daily. 2 of that season, Michigan played UCLA in the regular season, and then so I had 2 trips to the Rose Bowl. I remember they were just announced, no cheering in the press box, will eject anybody, any violators. And I remember just sticking with me, like, okay, I guess I better get used to it. And it's actually come very handy late in life, Sweeney, with 3 small kids. I realized early on that when a kid bumps into a wall or falls down and takes a nasty spill, what makes it worse is the reaction, the ooh, you know. So I've been accused of being very heartless in the house when something nasty happens and I don't react to it. That's
wow.
I react on the inside, but it's very helpful because when the kid doesn't hear ooh, and it makes the crying, I think, last a little shorter. But I never got in any trouble. But I mean, no matter what I do for the rest of my career, being at the World Series in 98, 99, 2000, covering the Subway Series,
mm-hmm,
and then, you know, the 9/11 World Series, covering that for ESPN, and being there and being at the Mr. November, and having, you know, although I was underneath the stadium trying to figure out which tunnel to exit,
yeah,
with the rest of the media based on who was going to win and lose. I mean, all of that being just being spit out into the stadium and watching 56,000 go nuts as Jeter had just finished rounding the bases for the Mr. November home run. I mean, I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it. It really is one of the highlights of anything I'll ever do in this business.
It's funny. First of all, I haven't learned the lesson that you learned. Like, I don't cheer in the press box, but I react badly when my kids fall. So I haven't learned that lesson.
It's the ooh. When you go like that, it confirms their fear that they just got hurt. Yeah. So try and suck it up.
Maybe you finally turned me. I will try to keep that in mind. You mentioned 2001, and you're always in my memory of the 2001 World Series. You know, I covered that as my first year covering the team on the beat. And you go through February, through November, into November. It's a long year. But what I remember with you specifically is we were, after Game 7, the day after, we're flying home, and you and I are next to each other in the security line, which was about 8 miles long, trying to leave Phoenix to go back home. And, you know, I mean, we had known each other just casually through the radio and the TV, but I just remember being in line with you for a very long time during that stretch.
Yeah, I mean, it really was a frightening yet amazing time. Certainly, you know, and what we're going through as a country right now, where there's so much polarization and there's so much division and such little common ground, that everybody really was together and cohesive. And baseball was the healing power mm-hmm. in many ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, from the fact that, you know, Shea Stadium was being used as a staging area for emergency services, and Yankee Stadium was the site of a memorial for first responders, and what Piazza did with John Franco and the Mets coming back and hitting that homer against the Braves was really, really special. And then the Yankees making the World Series. For New York, baseball was a major, major healing power. And to be at the front seat of it for that World Series, but it was downright nerve-wracking too. I remember, you know, Bank One Ballpark, home of the Diamondbacks, is right in the, I mean, directly in the landing area of the Phoenix Airport.
Right.
And we were told that planes were not going to be flying over that stadium. We were told that there would be no air traffic during the World Series, and yet, I remember as the players are warming up, I'm on the Sports Center set in the outfield, and the stadium roof is open, and I'm watching 747s fly over like it was, you know, LaGuardia.
Wow.
Next to Shea. And we were turning to each other, and the guy who I was turning to, because he was the analyst that was with me essentially on Sports Center for the entire World Series, to the point where we missed Game 2. They flew us home Game 2, ESPN. The Randy Johnson Game 2. We were blown at home, because we were the off-day crew that needed to be on the air in Yankee Stadium the next day.
Okay.
So the guy I was next to and flew with and was there all the time was with Buck Showalter.
Hmm.
And that was particularly, you know, it left me awestruck in many ways. First of all, as I just told you about, you know, 1995, and that was Buck, and the 94 strike, and what the Yankees would have done, I believe, had there been no strike.
Yeah.
There would have been that Yankee Expos World Series that I think everyone assumed would happen.
Yeah.
And then, so there you got a guy who's not only the former manager of the American League team we helped build, but the National League team in the Diamondbacks. He was their first manager. He helped build them.
Yep.
Not only helped build them, he helped build the stadium. He told me, Showalter told me one story as we're sitting there getting ready for a game. You know, it's a quiet moment. He started telling me about how, you know, he helped design the ballpark. Well, what do you mean? Well, if you remember, there was like this small sort of column of a dirt path between home plate and the pitcher's mound.
Yep.
It was his idea to just have that small column of dirt. Like the ceramic baseballs that were around the perimeter of the outdoor part of the stadium, he had that idea.
Hmm.
Also, he remembers jogging before the park opened up around the perimeter of the stadium, base paths all the way out to the warning track and then back to home plate. And he remembers running around the stadium to
Oh, yeah.
That they were in the wrong way.
Wow.
And that he had to make a call when he was done jogging that they brought in a crane and they lifted both foul poles and twisted them to get the netting into their territory. Because, you know, the ball hits the net, it shows you it's a fair ball.
Yeah.
Like, that's how granular a presence Buck was in the Diamondbacks ascension. And now here he is let go by both teams, and they're both in the World Series against each other. And it was really intense for him. And to be the guy who's sitting next to him the whole time was really, you know, out of body and bizarre for me. But, you know, then you go to Yankee Stadium for Game 3, and George Bush threw out the first pitch, mm-hmm. and that was like Fort Apache, the Bronx, where there were snipers on the roof and helicopters everywhere. Then some incredible games where the Yankees came back, Brosius' home run and Tino's home run, leading to Jeter's Mr. November to send this series back to Arizona, because the Yankees, you know, at least in my mind, they couldn't lose. Teams from New York can't lose the 9/11 World Series,
yeah.
Yet we all know what happened. That was an incredible World Series, sweetie. I mean, that really was. And then, you know, my wife, my then fiance, soon to be fiance and future wife, was covering it for Fox Sports West. So I remember sitting with her behind home plate in the eighth inning. We grabbed two seats, and we noticed we were amongst the Diamondbacks' wives, and as Mo Rivera blew them away in the eighth inning,
yeah.
The Diamondbacks' wives were crying over the inevitable.
Wow.
That never materialized, obviously, as we all know.
Wow. You know what I remember about that ninth inning is I had seats in the auxiliary press box out in the outfield, and as the ninth inning started, I started to make my way down towards the home plate side and get down towards the clubhouse because, you know, obviously going to cover the celebration. And I remember watching the entire Diamondbacks ninth inning rally unfold on a small TV in the basement level by the elevators. And everybody was lined up, all the crews, all the media was lined up outside the Yankees clubhouse, ready to go in to cover that celebration. As soon as the tying run scores, there was a stampede of camera crews, and you were probably right in the middle of it, a stampede of cameras and reporters and people from the first base side over to the third base side where the Diamondbacks clubhouse is going to be. I mean, honestly, you could have gotten crushed if you were standing in the middle of that.
Yeah. I mean, just intense. And that was the last World Series I covered.
Wow.
Because I was already at the NFL Network in 03, and then in 02, they didn't send me.
Mm.
So that's where I also realized there might be some writing on the wall. But you know, it was just incredible. And to be a lifelong Yankee fan and to be at ESPN starting my SportsCenter career, just joke with Joe Buck, because that was his first World Series, 96, the Yankees,
yep.
Six-game win over Atlanta, and Joe Girardi's triple,
yeah.
Against Greg Maddux, which is still one of the greatest hits in the history of Yankees postseason. Everybody loves to joke about Girardi's binder. He drives him crazy. He's still, I mean, he's got a place in Yankee postseason lore with his bat more than anything else. And Larrett's home run, the Pettit Game 5 went over Smoke, Rivera providing Wetland with the setup and all that stuff was just great. I watched it from my cubicle at ESPN. It was Joe Buck's first World Series, and it was my first year at ESPN. I remember just being so pissed because, you know, I couldn't get to Yankee Stadium. I was doing SportsCenter that night, so I remember thinking to myself, isn't this amazing? Yankees are finally in the World Series for the first time since, you know, Dave Rigetti lost to Fernando Valenzuela.
Yeah.
And I can't go down because I'm on SportsCenter with the irony of that, but my dreams come true, so I can't, you know, visualize my other dream in person. And just as I was just telling myself, you know, this is a first-class, high-class problem. Shut up.
Yeah.
Fox started showing the celebrities that were at the game, and they were all, like, on soon-to-be new Fox,
yeah,
you know, TV shows that were coming out, so they used it to promote their fall lineup. And I remember one of the people they showed sitting in a perfect seat was Kim Fields, the actress, Tootie, back to life. And I was thinking to myself, holy crap, you know, Tootie's at the game and I'm not. How the hell does that happen? But, you know, 98 is when I started doing stuff for ESPN and ESPN Radio covering baseball. And so to be it, 98, 99, 2000, 2001 World Series for ESPN, and it's still one of the blessings of my career.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because I swear to God, I think Mrs. Garrett sprayed me with champagne that night.
There you go.
I mean,
turn around, look out. There was Justine Bateman.
You know what? Listen, Rich, it just goes to show you: you take the good, you take the bad.
It is a fact of life. You are correct.
Hey, listen, the draft is coming up. The NFL draft is in Philadelphia this year, April 27th and 29th. Right on the Rocky Steps, right? You're going to be broadcasting outside from the Rocky Steps?
Yes. The podium is going to be on the steps of the museum. And I am being told that they're making the draftees walk down to the commissioner, which is a nice roll of the dice of these 320-pound guys. You know, we're hoping for good weather, and it's supposed to be an incredible scene. They're already building the draft town that's going out there right now, where you and I are talking 2 weeks removed from it. And, you know, that's what the NFL wants. You know, obviously anybody from New York will agree that Radio City Music Hall is as iconic as you can get.
Yeah.
Why would you want to move it out of there? The commissioner and the NFL kind of got tired of seeing people in the fourth balcony asleep during the sixth round of draft. And so they decided to move it. I think 1 year, Dolan helped aid that process by telling the NFL that the dates that they wanted for the draft were already taken by an Easter festival show that never materialized. So thank James Dolan once again. At least he didn't drag the draft out by its neck. They went to Chicago and put it in an iconic theater, but right across the street from Grant Park. And hundreds of thousands of Midwest football fans drove from places like Iowa and Wisconsin, Michigan, the Dakotas, Minnesota. I met people from Missouri, Arkansas. I mean, drove for a long way. Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio. And I think they saw the value in having it outdoors, giving the last day sort of a festival-like atmosphere to it and a celebratory atmosphere. So Chicago for 2 years, and then this year's Philadelphia, and I would be stunned if we are not in Jerry Jones's new palatial practice facility in Frisco, Texas next year. I'd be floored if we weren't there and having a big Texas-style draft. And that's what the NFL wants.
Listen, so, I'm curious, Rich, from your perspective, if the draft itself is fun. Now, I used to watch a lot more college football than I do, so I used to enjoy the draft a lot because I knew these players and I enjoyed seeing the things about them. But what's fascinating to me is the show that it has become, because I remember a couple of years ago just being floored by the fact that the NFL draft outrated on television actual NBA playoff games, including, you know, ones I think LeBron James and the Miami Heat were playing at the same time as the draft, and the draft drew a higher rating. I'm thinking, this is nuts. One of the greatest athletes of our time is playing playoff basketball right now, and more people would rather watch an old man walk up to the podium to announce names. I know the draft is like kind of the lifeblood and where the next generation of players comes from, but the actual process of it, I find fascinating how popular that is. Is it still fun for you?
Oh, yeah. It's a blast. I mean, it is the most physically challenging. I mean, I'm sitting on my ass, but I think I need to figure this out. This may be year 10 or 11 of me doing picks 1 through 256. Now Trey Wingo will be joining me in that club this time around. Yeah, it's a blast. I mean you pointed out, like, as opposed to the other highly popular draft in the NBA, you know most of the people who are being drafted. Like,
right.
The person who's sitting there wondering who, you know, the Chargers could draft to help launch the rebirth, or the Jet fan that's sitting there wondering who Jets might be able to pick at 6th overall to launch a rebirth, is not going to be some polyslavic, you know, polysyllabic Slovakian you've never seen play.
Right.
You know, I mean, there isn't going to be a Kristaps Porzingis moment in this draft because of that. And, you know, I think obviously that's a step up. Also, the fact that the NFL, more than any other major sport, you can go from outhouse to penthouse in 1 year, legitimately, that can actually happen. So the fact that you're sitting there and you're watching who your team can pick, I think that is helpful, that you can actually think that this is the dawning of a new age just by hearing one name called, although I would, you know, defend Roger Goodell that he's not an old man. I mean, he is in the late 50s. But at any rate, as we saw on your Twitter feed with your Jack Nicklaus comment the other day.
I'm old, man, yes.
You're an ageist. But, you know, more than anything else, it is a show, Sweeney, it is. I mean, more than ever, the NFL could do this like a fantasy draft and put it on an encrypted website, and everybody could pick their draft picks within a day. Instead, it's dragged out over a 3-day extravaganza.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in this day of social media, in this day of Twitter, as you know, the commissioner is no longer the disseminator of the information as to who's been picked.
Right.
It's some beat writer who gets it and tweets it out, because it's no longer a member of an NFL partner media group. That is not the case. If you're in business with the NFL, and you want to be in the business with the NFL, somebody in your media group is not tweeting out the result of the first round draft choice.
Yeah.
It's just not happening.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in the NFL, and obviously I'm biased because I'm a host of the television product, the NFL wants to maintain this as a television product. And to the point where the commissioner will sometimes be conducting business behind the scenes with, you know, with a group of veterans, or chit-chatting with a mom and a dad of a draftee that just got drafted. And we're sitting there going, okay, 3 picks are in and we haven't announced them yet, so let's get to them. So, you know, or sometimes ESPN is in commercial break and we're on the air, or vice versa, and the league has to wait till everybody's back from break to send the commissioner out to announce the pick. And meanwhile, if you're sitting at home on your Twitter feed, you know what picks 4, 5, and 6 are. We don't. I mean, we specifically tell our truck not to get in our ear to give us the information that most people already know.
Okay.
And if we suppose on the air we think it's this cornerback or this defensive end, and it actually materializes into the person we're talking about, then people are sitting at home thinking that we're faking, we're putting it on, we're fake news, or we're just trying to look smarter in their eyes, trying to pull their wool over their eyes. We just want to be kept in the dark. We want it to be a surprise. And I fear that we're going to be left in the new millennium dust one day, and that, you know, a generation who wants to know information right away in the palm of their hands does not want to sit around and have a show put on for them on a much bigger rectangle that's hanging on their wall.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but for the moment, I'm working in a product where that television product is still a viable, desired presentation of a very popular day, which is, by the way, the only event on an the NFL calendar where the principals themselves, the deciders, are not physically there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. The whole thing is really whack, and the NFL still does it the old school way, which is person in location, team location A, calls proxy of that team in Philadelphia at a draft table, who writes down the card and it's hand-delivered to a desk where it's recorded by the NFL and then written on a card for the commissioner. And by the way, the card that the commissioner reads is written out with the player's name already, which is phonetically spelled on the card, and the blank that they fill in is the team name and the draft number, selection, round, etc. That's what the card is. So they just grab the player card, Myles Garrett's card, write down Cleveland and then the number one and hand it to Roger, and he announces that that's the way the draft's done, which is so very 20th century if you think about it.
You're not letting Warren Beatty anywhere near this, are you?
Hell no. La La Land is not getting drafted in 2 weeks, Sweeney.
Listen, I've got so much more I would love to cover with you, but we're kind of out of time, so...
Well, I'm around. Let's do it again. Not a problem. You know how to reach me.
I would love to. I'd love to, you know, there's, your memory on some of these things is so outstanding, and, I love the detail that you provide and your experiences of it, and I've got material for another 30 with Murdy, if you are willing, so I appreciate, your time, and, the draft is still a fun event, and I hope you don't, you know, have any major injuries on the Rocky Steps. I hope Run Rich Run continues up the Rocky Steps.
I appreciate that, and maybe you should... You know, unfortunately, your last name doesn't rhyme with 60.
Yes.
So
yeah.
It might be a design flaw in your pod. Just tell me to point it out. But
listen, nine hole golf courses are very popular sometimes. So
very good. Well, call me back anytime. It's not a problem.
I truly do have so much more to talk to Rich about. He teamed, of course, with the late Stuart Scott on a very entertaining edition of SportsCenter in the late 90s and early 2000s. And Rich has also taken his NFL Combine 40-yard dash to great heights, annually turning it into a fundraiser for St. Jude Children's Hospital. It was an event that started on a whim with tongue-in-cheek, and it's now generated money for a worthy cause, and Rich deserves a laurel and hearty handshake for that. Hopefully, Rich will return as a guest, but I've got a lot more fun things coming this summer on the podcast, the first of our special features coming in just a couple weeks. I'll tell you more about that very soon. That's it for this edition of 30 with Murdy. Thanks for listening.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Dr. Mary Claire Haver, and my new podcast, Unpaused, is the place for bold, unfiltered conversations about what it takes for women to thrive in the second half of life. Listen to and follow Unpaused, available now wherever you get your podcasts.